Okay. How?
Hey.
He's like, oh, I can't tell. There's Jane.
Let the record reflect that it is 1:10 p.m. on Wednesday, May 13th, 2015. Present today, we have co-chair Representative Newman, vice chair Representative Sadler. Telephonically, we have Representative Edgman. We have Representative Gaddis, Representative Munoz, Representative Pruitt. Representative Wilson, Representative Guerra, and telephonically Representative Guttenberg, Representative Kawasaki, and myself, co-chair Representative Thompson. Before we start, please turn off your cell phones and electronic devices because they interfere with your recording equipment. This meeting will end at 2:30 p.m. since legislative budget and audit will be using this room at 3 p.m. for a meeting on the Hess audit. On this afternoon's schedule, we will continue our hearing on House Bill 148. Today we have a presentation from the Department of Law addressing Medicaid litigation. Here to present today from the Department of Law are Stacey Craley, Chief Assistant Attorney General, and Rachel Whitty, Assistant AG, and Andrew Peterson, Assistant AG. Also available to answer questions from the Department of Health and Social Services, we have Valerie Davidson, the Commissioner, Margaret Brody, Director of Health Care Services, Jared Coulson, Director of Office of Rate Review, this is a provider tax, and John Sherwood, Deputy Commissioner, Ron Crusher, Director of Division of Public Assistance, Dwayne Mays, Director of Division of Senior and Disability Services, and online we have Al Wall, Director of Division of Behavioral Health, and we have Ms. Craley and Ms. Woody and Mr. Peterson. If you please come to the table, place yourselves on the record, and we'll begin your presentation. We've also been joined by Representative Vasquez, Representative Foster, Representative Olson, and in the room was Speaker Chenault. I don't see any others out there at this time. And we do have three chairs up here. If Representative Vasquez Foster want to come up and join us, we have chairs on both sides here if you'd like to.
Can you turn it up?
Okay. Go ahead with your presentation, please.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Stacey Craley, the Chief Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law, and with me is Rachel Whitty, Assistant AG with the Civil Division at the Department of Law. Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to present to the committee today, and I want to give you a brief overview of who I am and why I've been chosen to give this presentation, and then we'll go through a short PowerPoint presentation. As I stated, I'm a Chief Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the Department of Health and Social Services. I supervise a section of 10 attorneys, including 9 attorneys. There's 10 in my section, including myself. And we provide all of the legal representation for the Department of Health and Social Services, except for child in need of aid proceedings. We do a little bit of work for the Office of Children's Services, but mainly we don't do day-to-day child proceedings. My section has, at any given time, 4 to 5 full-time attorneys working on Medicaid-related matters. This includes a full-time attorney who deals with Medicaid audits and sanctions, which relate to provider relationships. Another full-time attorney who does Medicaid recovery, which includes third-party liability, trust and estate recovery, and then anywhere between the equivalent of 2 full-time attorneys, but it branches over a variety of different individuals, between 2 to 5 attorneys who work on representing and advising the department on various matters related to the Medicaid program, including working on regulations, advising on legislation, representing the department in administrative fair hearings, civil litigation, and Supreme Court appeals.
When you give your presentation, for the records keepers and people that are watching or listening online, if you could indicate when you change to the next slide, and slide 2, slide 3, I appreciate that. Thank you.
In preparing for the presentation, I was asked to discuss 3 different topics: the Xerox litigation, other litigation related to DHSS, and then efforts in of the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. And at that point, Mr. Peterson will join me and put himself on the record.
During the presentation, would you prefer us to wait till the end to ask questions, or if committee members have questions during the presentation, is it all right if we interrupt you?
It's perfectly fine to interrupt, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, proceed.
And my only final preface is that when we talk about some of this litigation, we will try to be as responsive as possible to the questions that are posed by the committee, but I want to remind the committee that I'm going to talk about active litigation, including the Xerox case, so to the extent we're able to answer your questions, we will, and it may be, we hopefully won't have to tell you that some of this stuff we'll have to get back with you on, but we'll try and be as responsive as possible. So with that, I'll get started.
Thank you.
So I want to start on slide 3 of my presentation. The first topic is to talk about the Xerox litigation.
That's crazy, crazy.
So, okay, there we go. In 2007, as has been testified in the previous committee hearings, DHSS contracted with Xerox to develop and operate a new Medicaid management information system. There are two major parts of this contract. There was the design, development, and implementation, the DDI phase, which Ms. Brody testified to, and then also the ongoing operation of the system. So once the system is certified, then Xerox will continue to do the day-to-day operations of the program. The contract encompasses both components. Next slide.
Slide 4.
The purpose of the litigation, which was filed in September of 2014, was to get Xerox to operate or get to a fully functional system. At the time that we filed the litigation, there were choices that were made as to whether or not we could terminate or we should terminate the contract or whether or not we should move towards mediation and go to additional remedies that are offered under the contract. We chose not to terminate the contract, but instead litigate other remedies under the contract and to work closely with Xerox to fix the system.
We have a question from Representative Sadler.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Cleary, just want to confirm there's a couple different avenues of redress the state of Alaska has against Xerox. I understand there actually is civil litigation. There's also hearings before an administrative law judge. I just want to make sure, is litigation you're speaking of in court, or is it an admin law judge, or what's the difference for the people listening?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, and it will be later in the presentation, but this case was filed in front of the Office of Administrative Hearings, so it's an administrative hearing. It's not. We did not file a case in Superior Court.
But this is still, so this is still rightfully considered litigation before administrative hearing?
Through the chair, that's correct.
Thank you. Continue.
As has been testified previously in front of the committee, sorry, I went to the next slide, I didn't need to, the litigation has appeared to motivate Xerox to prioritize the Alaska project and has resulted in significant improvements in the program. As Ms. Brody testified earlier this week, since the claim was filed, Xerox has developed and implemented a corrective action plan and claims processing and has worked to resolve system defects. Slide number 5. As has been testified and as the committee is aware, Xerox and DHSS, the department determined to go live with the new system on October 1st, 2013. Immediately,
Representative Sather has another question.
Thank you. I appreciate the chance to ask questions as we proceed. Ms. Cleary, yesterday we heard that Ms. Brody told us that there was some confusion about whether the state of Alaska decided on its own volition to go live or if it relies entirely on Xerox's representation that it should. And there's a question as to whether the state should have or could have maintained the old system. In the work so far, has that been clarified as to whose decision it was to go live without the legacy system continuing in a parallel fashion?
Do you know the answer to that?
To the chair, Representative Sadler,
Ms. Wiley? Whitty.
Rachel Whitty. In the claim, I can tell you that DHSS alleged that it was based on representations by Xerox that the new system was ready to go, and that there was, it's my understanding that and able to maintain the two systems at the same time. It wasn't, at a certain point you have to cut over. You can't keep inputting information to both systems at the same time and run them simultaneously. I would defer to someone with more substantive expertise on that, but in our claim we alleged that it was based on Xerox's representations that we made that decision.
The decision to go live
and to cut over from the old legacy system.
We've been joined in the back of the room by Representative Josephson. We do have chairs open if you'd like to join us up here at the table. Continue, please.
Thank you. As waning days of summer last year, in August and September, the Department of Law, in consultation with the Department of Health and Social Services, evaluated its many options under the contract and determined that the contract required that the parties engage in alternative dispute resolution. And so we initiated provisions of the contract that required a mediation, and the parties engaged in a two-day mediation in September of 2014 that was held here in Anchorage, and the mediation, although highlighted and addressed a number of significant issues, was ultimately not successful. Slide number six. As a result of the failed mediation in September of 2014, DHSS filed a contract claim with the Office of Administrative, with the Commissioner of Administration, and it was referred to the Office of Administrative Hearings. This claim sought the following relief: development of an acceptable corrective action plan, completion and correction of deliverables necessary for a fully operational system that can be certified by the federal government, and finally, payment of liquidated damages and other damages resulting from the delays and the lack of functionality. Slide seven. A hearing on the liquidated damages was held in February 18th and 19th of 2015. And the parties, well, to back up a little bit, before the hearing was held, it was determined that we would have an initial hearing on liquidated damages and that we would bifurcate and then have a more robust hearing on the other issues related to the claim in August of 2015. So the a two-day hearing was held in Anchorage here in February of 2015, and the breach of contract claim is scheduled to be heard in August of 2015.
Mr. Chair. That's Senator Garrett.
Thank you. Just a... at your discretion at some point, I'd like to ask a couple questions of the commissioner. I've got to say, I don't know why we're rehashing this litigation when we should be debating a bill, but that's just me.
Continue, please.
In April of this year, the parties agreed to stay the litigation, so the hearing in August is it hasn't been taken off of the calendar, but it's been stayed as the parties work towards completion of the corrective action plan and a hopeful determination by DHSS that the program will be acceptable to the department, and if that's the case, then the hearing in August will be taken off of the calendar. Slide number eight. As a result of the agreement to stay, the parties are now in what we're going to call the acceptance kind of phase of the contract negotiations. So on or before July 31st, the parties are to meet and establish whether or not the system is acceptable to the department, which means that all major defects have been resolved, all deliverables are complete, and Xerox can be released from the implementation phase of the contract and move towards operations.
I have a question from Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Crowley, concerning these two paragraphs here, it says that the department will have to certify that all major defects have been resolved. We don't know for a while until what happens to pop up within the new Xerox program. We have new coding that's coming on, requirements from the federal government. So, if I may, how can you certify that all major defects have been resolved in a system that's had so many complications up to this point? You know that you won't have any in the future.
Through the chair, Co-Chair Newman, I think it's important to realize that the system will, as testified to previously by Director Brody, there will always be issues with the system. There's always going to be functionality and improvements that will need to be addressed. So the concept that is articulated in these two points relates to the idea that there have been, and we have identified through the corrective action plan a list of correctables, of defects that need to be identified, and those are the defects that we are just discussing at this point. There will be additional add-ups to the system, as was testified to with the ICD-10 codes, and that may lead to other issues, but those issues are not part of this consideration. There will be constant improvement in additions that will need to be made to the program as long as the program is operational.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Crowley, so I'm we bought, or just the state bought a program from Xerox that was supposed to be fully implementable to move in and take over from the old 26-year-old system, which they needed to do. There's been a lot of problems that have happened in that, so I just want to clarify that Xerox will not be held liable for any complications in the future after July 31st, 2015, if you sign off on everything that they've done so far.
Through the chair, Representative Newman, Co-Chair Newman, no. Xerox, there's a contract that addresses both the design and development of the system and then the operations of the program, including additional change orders that will be requested in the future. And Xerox will be held accountable for those changes as they occur in the future.
One more question.
Follow up, Representative Newman. One more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more, member's time. So, is there an opportunity here to have an independent auditor or analyst who looks at these programs and understands these programs much more than probably any of us legislators would, that can make us feel more comfortable that the signing off on Xerox programs that have a lot of problems, is there an opportunity here where we should probably have somebody independent outside the state of Alaska that knows how these programs work come and look and say, yes, this program is up and working and is satisfactory and doing exactly what it was supposed to do?
To the chair, Co-Chair Newman, the state right now has under contract a technical assistance contractor, and they are also known in the industry as an independent verification and validation contractor. And they are a third party that's assessing the system and whether Xerox is complying with the corrective action plan. And then in addition to that, we have the check of the federal government, CMS. If the system doesn't do all the things that it's supposed to be doing and in order to process claims, then we'll also have that check against DHSS's own assessment that the system is doing everything it needs to do.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. If we could maybe ask the department, you know, the problems that they've had, I've never seen a list of the problems that they're working on right now. If we could maybe get some of that so we have an idea of what we're talking about.
Specifics of what they are.
Okay. Yeah, and what they're doing to resolve them. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Munroz.
On this point, please. Thank you. Previously, we heard testified that there were 38 items that needed to be fixed that were subject to the corrective action plan. Are all of those actions or must-haves consistent with what the federal requirements would be? Are those... Would that be an additional list of demands?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, I don't think the two items are mutually exclusive. The list that has been identified, as I understand it, the must-haves that were testified to previously are items that DHSS have identified that are required to be addressed in order to get to the acceptance phase. As part of that acceptance phase, the department will be engaging with the federal government, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and also with the contractor that Ms. Witte mentioned earlier to identify to make sure that those things will ultimately lead to certification. So whether they are the exact same things that the federal government would be looking at, I don't know, but I don't think they're mutually exclusive of each other. They go hand in hand.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Crealy, help us kind of go, we're getting kind of into the weeds a little bit in operations, and that's essential for us to do, but kind of go to a 40,000-foot level and tell us, some of you that are listening and watching, what's at stake for the state, both in terms of the finances, the operations, the fines, the penalties. Kind of give us a context of why this is important, why this case is important to Alaskans.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, a functioning Medicaid management information system is critical to the administration of the Medicaid program, and I think that has been testified to by the commissioner and Ms. Brody over the past 2 days. It's necessary to operate the Medicaid program. With respect to getting to acceptance and certification, as has been testified to previously, those two functions lead to federal dollars for both the development of the program and then the operation of the program. So for in order to get certification from the federal government, we have to have, they have to approve the system, which then means they will pay for 90% of the total cost of the development of the program. Right now they're paying 50% of that cost. Once we get certified, they will backfill that additional 40%. So they will have covered 90% of the total cost of the program. As to the operation phase, which is the functionality going forward, they will pay 75% of the operation of that program. So certification leads to enhanced federal funding for the operation of the program.
Can you follow up that same sadly?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Can you confirm the reason why the reimbursement rate for the administrative work has gone from 75% to 50%? Is that due to some error in the state's part, or in Xerox's part?
Through the chair, Representative Sather, I don't believe it's based upon an error. I believe it's a functionality of they don't pay you the enhanced rate until you get certified.
Mm-hmm. My understanding was from the affidavit yesterday that it was basically a sanction because the system was not up and running, but the reimbursement was reduced from 75 to 50. I'll confirm that, but okay. Okay, so was the state operationally, what about the finances? The previous testimony has developed that the state is on the hook for some payback to the federal government. There's potential fines, error rates, and so forth. What are the financial implications of this case to the state?
Through the chair, Representative Sackler, as was testified previously, and it's our position that the impact to the state is, I would characterize it as to be made whole. So if we have paid providers in error, then we've overpaid, then we have to pay back the federal government that additional payment. If we've underpaid, then once it's reconciled, the federal government will give us that money back. So there are no penalties or sanctions per se. There are, it's a matter of ultimate accounting reconciliation at the end of the day, that the federal government is not overbilled for services that we have paid out and not underbilled for services that we have paid out.
My last call, I'll stop then. My understanding from reading the affidavit of Ms. Brody was that the state may never recover some of the money. You're saying that it will all come out in the wash, but some of the information in the affidavit says that it's unlikely the state will ever recover some of this money.
Through the chair, Representative Sather, I think I can just preface my answer about Ms. Brody's affidavit. I think it's important to put the affidavit in context. Not only was it a point in time, but it was filed in response to a motion by Xerox saying our liquidated damages clause was unenforceable because they said that the state's actual damages were so minimal compared to the amount of damages that we said had accrued due to the liquidated damages clause that it should be struck from the contract as unenforceable. And so the affidavit of Margaret Brody was to support the state's position that these damages are difficult to calculate, and under the law, this is that type of situation why you would put a liquidated damages clause in the contract. So just to give a little context to her affidavit, but another point is that although we don't know what the ultimate damages might be if the state does have to repay money and we can't recoup it and there's some accounting reconciliation issues, one reason why we haven't dismissed the lawsuit, even if the system improves, is because at the end of the day, we're gonna look and see, and if it turns out the state has to repay money and we aren't able to get it all back, then we can still go after Xerox for it.
Thank you. Another one, Representative Sadler, on page 8 of her affidavit, she says that our current outstanding balance is $104 million. She said it was now 95. This amount will likely never be fully recovered due to costs in fiscal years, et cetera. And just wanted to point, on page 7, it does say that CMS has dropped the state's reimbursement rate from 75% FMAP to 50% as a result of the continuing delays in fixing defects and completing implementation. So, yes, you're correct. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Garrett,
and
Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's just be clear about this. Representative Sadler said the reimbursement rate, and that just has to do with the reimbursement rate for the cost of this system, not the reimbursement rate for health care services. He said that it's gone down from 75 to 50%, but it will retroactively go back to 75% once the system is certified. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that's correct.
Thank you. And when that happens, it'll be as if it's been 75% the whole time in terms of reimbursements to the state, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that's correct.
Thank you. One other thing we heard yesterday was... Thank you, Mr. Chair, sorry. One other thing we heard yesterday was, with all the improvements that you forced through litigation, and I appreciate the work, but with all the improvements you've enforced through litigation, this system is now up to roughly 95% accuracy in terms of billing. Is that your understanding?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that's my understanding.
Thank you. And through the chair...
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, the chair. And not only is it up to 95% accuracy, but those other 5% of claims, they get paid by the next billing cycle or the next two billing cycles, so everything is paid by them. And at that point, it's essentially 100% accurate. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that's my understanding.
Thank you. One final question, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Representative Garrett.
Thank you. So with these improvements, now that this, by the first or second billing cycle after billing, all billings are paid, do you see any reason why we can't go ahead with Medicaid expansion at this point?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, I do not.
Thank you.
Representative Gaddis.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm commenting to what Representative Newman, kind of carrying on with that. One of my concerns as I listen, as your administration's point of view, and realizing that we're in litigation with Xerox at this time, but I don't hear the other side, and it's a little bit uncomfortable for me not to hear both sides at this time. Just kind of hear what the other side has to say, and let their, you know, whether we're ready to go as well. So, I mean, certainly not disparaging. It's just uncomfortable hearing just from one side, and realizing that that's kind of tough during litigation to do that, but we're not getting both sides' things.
Representative Sadler?
No, I'll pass.
No, I'll pass. That's any good.
Okay, so I was going to ask a little bit about the money aspect of this whole thing. But I also want to ask something else before we get... talk to me about your understanding of the system as you have gone through this process as an attorney. Are you now, I mean, would you consider yourself very capable of understanding the full ramifications of the system through your time as working through this litigation?
through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I've been representing the Department of Health and Social Services for 15 years, and in that time I've represented the Medicaid agency in its various iterations. I work very closely with all of the divisions in the Commissioner's Office on a myriad of Medicaid problems. I'm actively involved in this litigation, although I'm not one of the attorneys who has entered an appearance in this litigation. I feel very comfortable talking about the impact of the MMIS system on the operations of the department, as well as the impact of the litigation as it relates to the Medicaid system.
Okay, thank you. So I'm going to move to the... I'm going to move to the money real quick. As we talk about the discussion that we've had, we focused mostly, we had a little bit of $104 million that we were behind, but is there also additional discussion about, for instance, the any penalties that we may have to pay? Penalties, labor costs on our side. What's the full ramification of the potential benefit to us? It's not really a benefit, but recuperation that we can have on the system or on the litigation from the Xerox's faults in this whole thing, and what does it cover? Is it just the money that we may not receive back from the federal government, or are we able to include all of the other potential challenges that we've seen, whether it's our labor costs, those kinds of things?
Through the chair, Representative, I want to make sure I understand your question. Are you asking what the potential damages are that the state can recover from Xerox?
Yeah, but I want to make sure that I understand that not just what are the damages, but what all do they include? I mean, are we getting back our payroll costs that we're paying our people to kind of cover for Xerox? Are we getting back the federal loss, the money from that we're losing from the federal government? Any future financial actions? Are we getting back money for any of the lawsuits, which I think you guys are going to address some of the other challenges that we've had because of the system, some lawsuits that are going to the system. Are all of those items included in the money that we're potentially going to get back, the damages that we're going to get back, I just want to make sure that we're going to be whole after this, since it's really, it's cost us substantial amount on our side. I'm just curious if we're going to be able to, how close to the hole are we going to be by the time we're through this?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, and maybe Ms. Woody can add to this. The purpose of the litigation as it was filed was to ultimately get a functioning system, because that is the ultimate goal. We need a functioning system. As part of the litigation, we raised a number of claims in the accusation that we filed, including a claim for liquidated damages. Under the contract, there's a provision in the contract that allows for liquidated damages. Xerox is contesting that provision, and as Ms. Woody testified to just a moment ago, has argued that the liquidated damages should be held unenforceable because they argued in that litigation, and this was all part of their hearing, so it's part of the public record, that the damages that we were assessing or that we had identified were so large in comparison to the actual damages we were suffering. As a result, Ms. Brody drafted and assisted in drafting the affidavit for Ms. Brody in response to that claim and identified that the damages that the state has suffered are large, are significant, but are difficult to quantify for a variety of different reasons, because we aren't actually going to know the numbers that are going to be, you aren't going to be able to, using the phrase I used previously, reconcile the actual damages for quite some time potentially. And that's the purpose of the liquidated damages provision under the law, which is to identify a penalty, if you will, because you fail to perform and you can't quantify those damages. So just to give you that context, so my answer to your question would be, it is our expectation at the end of the day, when this litigation is over, that one, we will have a functioning system, and two, there will be some remuneration of some form or fashion from Xerox related to some of these damages. How much that will be, or how we will quantify and calculate that, is part of the litigation, which is currently in front of the Administrative Hearing Office, but it's also numbers that need to be reconciled once everything settles in.
In the end, let's say that we're successful with our liquidated damages. Is U.S. going to make any money off of this whole system?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, they will receive, once, as I stated, there's two parts of this contract. There's the design and development and implementation phase of it, and then there's the operation part of it. At the end of the day, when the system is up and operating and certified by the federal government, we will be in a contractual relationship with Xerox, as they will manage and operate the program, so they will be receiving funds for doing that. Whether or not they're making money off of the project, you'd have to ask Xerox.
So can I clarify? So the question, here's the question. I get that we're going to pay them, but if we potentially are going to get back from them due to our liquidated damages, a substantial amount more than we potentially pay them for the system, at what point do they, and what legal opportunity do they have to look at us and at some point say, all right, we're not going to do business with you anymore, you're a bad customer, and then we're left with this system? That's where I'm headed. Are they going to make money, and then at some point in time, if they decide, because they're, unlike government, they cannot lose money. So they have to make money at some point in time. So when do they say, we're not making any money, they step back? And then what is our recourse at that point in time if they step back? And we now have this system that we are depending on them to continue to keep whole for a considerable period of time.
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, at the end of the day, should Xerox determine that they don't want to participate in this contractual arrangement again, then we would have a breach of contract action against them, and we would litigate that, their termination of the contract. Unless it was a mutual termination, but if they left on a unilateral termination, we would have additional claims. The litigation that we have right now is but one remedy that the state has with respect to Xerox. It's not the exclusive remedy. It's not the sole remedy that we have. We have additional remedies under the contract up to and including, you know, should we want to terminate the contract. We don't want to terminate the contract. We want an operating system. So if Xerox were to walk away from us unilaterally, then the state would evaluate and pursue all of its remedies under the contract.
So final question, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Representative Pruitt.
So then, so let's say that they do not walk away from it. How long is their contract for maintenance after it's all put in place? How long is that for? Do we know?
Ms. Woody?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I believe that it's through 2019 right now with options to renew, but I think we would have to get back to you on that to confirm the date.
Okay, I lied. Can I one more follow-up on that?
Go ahead.
So we used the last system for 26 years. This system is built, and in the core is some stuff that we're really struggling with, and we have just indicated that we potentially have them to 5 years. They could lose a substantial amount of money and after 5 years decide that they don't want to go forward with it. At that point, we're stuck with a very large system, very expensive system that they've chosen potentially not to continue to assist us with. What is our recourse at that point in time?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, our options would be to litigate with Xerox again if they unilaterally left, but we would have, I mean, the system is our system. We would then bring in a new operator and would run the system through a different operator.
Okay.
May I just clarify my answer to the last question? I have a copy of the contract here, and I just looked in it. The contract expires in September of 2017 as of right now.
And I think it's renewables up to like 25 years or something. Something like that. Anyway, I'd like to remind members that we are going to end this meeting at 2:30 because of labor and legislative audit budget needing to use the room. We aren't even halfway through the presentation yet, so keep that in mind. Representative Sadler.
Mr. Chair, I'll talk fast. Just to restate again, the enterprise system was went go live in October of 2013. They're 4 years behind schedule, according to what Xerox told the state. We're 2 months into corrective action, which Xerox has promised to do better this time. We told the people when we get up that there's nothing regarding the enterprise system that stands the way of Medicaid expansion today. My question is the enterprise system certified now? And if it's not certified, if we expanded Medicaid today, would we receive the enhanced FMAP today?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the system is not certified.
It is not certified.
It is not certified. But certification would not impact the enhanced federal match for the expansion population. We would still receive the 100% federal match going through 2016 if we were to expand as HB 148 indicates on August 1st. It would not impact that.
So why would you certify it then?
Through the chair, Representative Stavros, certification is related to the functionality of the system or the operation of the system. It doesn't have anything to do with the federal match for the reimbursement from the federal government for services that are provided. Certification has to do with whether or not the system is the MMIS system, the Medicaid Management Information System, meets certain protocols set by the federal government, but it doesn't impact payment. As an example, we are getting our 50% match today for all of the services that we're providing today, and we're getting the additional, I think we get a little bit more than that for certain children and pregnant women. Those matching dollars are coming in every day, every week, every month from the federal government, despite the fact we don't have a certified program.
I said one and that one. Thanks.
All right, continue, Ms. Grayley.
Well, let's see. I think we've talked a lot about some of this stuff through these questions, so I can skip through a lot of these slides. Slide 9 talks a little bit about the certification and the concept of certification and what it means for the funding for the program from the federal government. Slide 10, again, talks about certification, so that's a little repetitive. So that's it on those were the slides I had on the Xerox litigation.
Mr. Chin, one clarification.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 9, you have for operations of the MMIS system, the federal government pays 75% of that cost, and the state pays 45%. So are we going to get paid over 100%?
I think that's
through the chair, Representative Wilson, might be nice, but that's just a typographical error.
It'd be 25%.
I apologize.
And one follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
So since one of the biggest, the next big thing that's going to happen is in October with all the coding, why would we not wait on the Xerox litigation and everything else until that biggest test happens, or until certification, one of the two things, versus doing it beforehand.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I don't believe I'm qualified to answer the first part of your question, because I think Director Brody and the Commissioner spoke about that yesterday, and they're comfortable with that. I don't have an opinion on whether or not we should wait on that. I trust their judgment that it will operate and it will do what it's designed to do. As to your second question, certification is not, as I mentioned to Representative Sadler, is not the trigger for reimbursement from the federal government for the provision of services. So waiting for certification to expand does not, in my opinion, does not quite make sense, because we can, the money that we can receive from the federal government, we will get that regardless of certification.
And that's not my question. I'm sorry, Ms. Trinity tried it. I'm talking about just our agreement with Xerox. Why we wouldn't wait for one of the two things to happen? Because it seems like anytime something big happens, that's when we find more glitches. So you already answered the question why October, because that would be the department. But so the other part would be, why would we not wait to take care of the litigation until after the certification for Xerox, not having anything to do with expansion or not? I'm just looking at, do other states, when they've changed over, not wait? Because to me, the certification is kind of a stamp of approval of the federal government, saying that you're where you need to be, we're going to start paying the way that we are going to. So my question just is, you know, when we have these two kind of landmark things, why would we not wait to say, okay, Xerox, we're going to keep moving forward like we are, but we're not going to let you off the hook until this next big happening happens under the certification, because that's kind of another third party doing it. So it's more on the certification being tied than it is to any adding anybody else.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, if I understand your question correctly, we are in a status quo position with Xerox right now. We have not withdrawn the litigation or the claim for liquidated damages, and we are able to reinstitute or go back off of the stay and or address additional claims, as I mentioned to Representative Pruitt, should there be additional problems in the future. So we don't intend on letting Xerox not perform under the contract in the future, and so there really is no need to wait until those two milestones are fit. We're moving forward on a day-to-day basis.
And I guess, Mr. Chair, maybe this would be something that we need to look at during the interim is, have any other states, when they've changed over, not used certification as kind of a stamp of approval versus move forward with that? Thank you.
You know, one of the problems that we're looking at with this whole system is that when they decided to go live, they had tested it with a certain amount of throughputs. It seemed to work. It didn't seem to have a problem until they put the big load on, and then it exploded and it created a problem. Now the system is working, but we're going to add 20,000 to 40,000 new people, 70,000 new NCCI codes all at one time. Is the system, we don't know if it's going to be able to handle it or if we're going to have another meltdown. So that's one of the concerns of the committee, to make sure that we do have something that's going to work when it gets overloaded. So that's one of the reasons that we're asking questions and trying to follow up on this. Go ahead, Ms. Crayley, with your presentation.
Moving on in the presentation, I'll go to slide 12. One of the topics that was requested by the committee was to talk about ongoing litigation that DHSS, the department, has, and then also to talk about a couple of federal cases. So the first case on the slide is a case, an active litigation that we have right now, the Filipino American Assisted Living Providers against DHSS. This is a case that has been filed against the department related to its development of regulations to establish cost-based rates for assisted living homes. At this point, the case is in kind of in a lull. We've prevailed on all motion practice that we've filed in that case, and have one final issue to brief related to licensing claims. Slide 13 is a current case, Putnam and Brown versus the State of Alaska DHSS. This is litigation that was filed by two Medicaid recipients who were challenging our determination that they no longer met nursing facility level of care and could no longer have their services paid for in a nursing home. The allegations that have been raised is that we should use the same process that we use for home and community-based waivers, which is to establish that they have, quote-unquote, materially improved.
Representative, I sadly have a question on that one.
Actually, no, it was in the previous one, the Filipino-American Assisted Living Providers, slide 12. Yes, slide 12, to engage in cost. Can you put that in a little more plain English for me and for the folks listening? Did you try to lower the reimbursement rate? Did you try and set a rate? What's the issue here?
Representative Saber, through the chair, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, the legislature and the department discussed a variety of different issues about maintaining consistency within the assisted living home arena and go to what is called cost-based rates, which is also required by the federal government. The department engaged in a regulatory proposal to require assisted living homes to engage in cost-based reporting, which was a fundamental shift, if you will, from how they had been having their rates established prior to that. A number of assisted living homes participated in that, provided cost-based reports and certified accounting records, and a variety of homes just didn't like that new plan and filed this litigation, arguing that the system that we were engaging in through the regulations was too extensive and not effective, and so they filed suit, and like I said, we've prevailed on all claims thus far.
Thank you, that helps.
Okay, continue.
I'm still on slide 13, so I think I'm done with that one, except that case is active, and we've got oral argument at the end of June. Henderson versus the Department of Health and Social Services, Healthcare Services. This is litigation related to the department's development of protocols regarding the approval of the drug Sovaldi, the new drug that has been established that has proved quite effective in treating hepatitis C. It's also extremely expensive, costs almost $85,000 a treatment. So the department established protocols to determine when and how individuals with hepatitis C who are Medicaid eligible would be able to take advantage of this treatment. We have been sued arguing that our protocols, as I note here, violated the Administrative Procedures Act, that they discriminate under the federal rules related to the Medicaid Act, and also that our notice violated due process. That case is in its infancy. We're in discovery and motion practice at this time. The final state case I want to talk about is a recent case, Napalu versus Senior Disability Services. This case was filed within the last month, and it essentially alleges that a dispute over how the department establishes or how the division assesses needs for personal care services, and argues that the ability to that the division should use the assessment only as the benchmark for eligibility and qualification for personal care, as opposed to what the department does, which is use a more global evaluation, evaluating records, talking to medical providers and other family members, and we don't rely solely upon the assessor. To be clear, those are four cases that I wanted to highlight. Those are active litigation. We have a myriad of additional cases that the department deals in at the administrative Office of Administrative Hearings, dealing with Medicaid provider audits, and also recipient fair hearings with respect to the denial, suspension, or termination of Medicaid benefits. These are the Superior Court cases that we have right now. We were also asked to talk very briefly about two federal cases that are pending. And the first one is King versus Burwell, which is a case that is before the United States Supreme Court. The basic issue in the case relates to, under the Affordable Care Act, individuals who purchased insurance through the exchanges have been provided with tax credits. And the question in front of Burwell is whether or not those tax credits can be provided
if you purchase the insurance through the federal exchange. There's a provision in the Affordable Care Act that indicates that you can only get the tax credit if you apply through a state exchange, and so the litigation is asking whether or not that the provision, if you bought a, if those tax credits are available through the federal exchange.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's pretty, obviously, the state of Alaska does not have its own state-based health benefits exchange. We rely on the federal, so we are at issue in the Blue Bell case, correct?
Through the chair, that is correct.
What is it true that the IRS would stop paying? So what would be the impact if the Blue Bell case goes against the federal administration's position?
Well, the, through the chair, Representative Sadler, the ultimate impact is the estimated 5 to 8 million individuals who received tax credits through the federal exchange, of which I believe there's, I don't know the math, there's 21,000 Alaskans who have applied through the federal exchange, 90% of whom have received some sort of tax, some sort of credit or tax credits. So those individuals would no longer have those tax credits.
Would they be expected to the chair would those Alaskans be required to repay those tax credits?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I do not know the answer to that question. Would I would assume not, but
okay.
I don't know.
Follow up, Representative Sadler.
Would if people would the state of Alaska have any obligation to those people as a result of that if the bullet decision goes against the administration? Would the state of Alaska have any obligation to step in to pick up the extra costs? Would they be required to provide Medicaid services or other health care provisions for those people?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the state of Alaska certainly could step in and do a myriad of different fixes, if you will, or attempt to assist to hold individuals who are losing those tax credits harmless. But at this point, those questions are hypothetical and those answers are hypothetical because we don't, I don't know, but the state certainly could step in and provide fixes.
Right. Thank you. But my question was, would we be obligated to do so? We could, certainly, but would we be obligated?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I don't believe you would be obligated to do anything.
Okay. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's the issue that I was going to pursue, because when I talked to many Alaskans around the state who are currently receiving those credits, again, you said 21,000 Alaskans, and so we're talking about expanding the system to accept another 20 to 40,000 people, but we have 21,000 Alaskans that are currently receiving these credits. We're going to lose out on that. And I would expect that we would have something in House Bill 148 that would address the needs of those Alaskans who are going to lose those credits, and probably if they're forced to apply for it under the Obamacare legislation. So if, I would expect something like that in that legislation. When we talk about reform, Mr. Chair, this is one of the big issues for a lot of concerns within Alaska. And so I don't know if we can ask the Department of Law to come up with some options on maybe that we could consider to make sure that we don't lose those 21,000 Alaskans who are currently covered, or put additional expenses on them because the state decides to expect or expand Medicaid expansion.
Thank you, Representative Newman. Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you. So the 21,000, do we know what is the income levels for people that would have to who would qualify for some sort of assistance or the tax credit? What are those levels?
Well, I'd have that somewhere in here. Through the chair, Representative Pruitt. Let me see if I can find it real quick.
Some of the most need.
Roughly speaking, insurance is made available to those with credits with incomes from 133 to 400% of the federal poverty line, which means an individual making approximately $16,000 to $47,000 would be required to purchase coverage but would no longer receive any help should the case rule against, should the court rule against the administration. So, I'm not an expert on this. That's just information that I researched while I was preparing for this hearing. So the department may have more accurate information on that.
Can I just clear? You said 133 to 400% below the federal poverty line. Is that what it is?
The 133 to 400% of the federal poverty guideline.
Okay. And I'm
So that
we might have to have, yeah, we might have to be covered, because I don't think 16,000 to 47 is the 133 to 40. So we might have to, I know it's just maybe real brief from the commissioner there.
Commissioner, place yourself on the record so they can be able to record it properly.
Thought you were done.
Brianna, Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Valerie Davidson, Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services. Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, the federal the subsidized insurance available on the federally facilitated marketplace in Alaska is based upon, you're eligible if you are between 100 to 400% of the federal poverty level. In terms of state versus federal-based exchanges, every state had the opportunity to develop their own state-based exchange by a certain date. There were actually federal grants that were made available to states to be able to take advantage and build those systems. For states that were unable or chose not to develop their own state-based exchange, they were subject to the federally, they had to avail themselves to the federally facilitated marketplace. And so because Alaska chose not to build a state-based marketplace, Alaskans are subject to the federally facilitated marketplace. They changed the name from exchange to marketplace. I'm sorry, I keep calling them both. It's the same thing. Previously, this issue was addressed by the department in a letter to Senator Coghill. It was actually addressed by the Commissioner of Insurance in a memorandum that we can make available to the committee. It was dated Tuesday, April 14th. And what the options for the state are, one is doing a traditional state-based exchange, which Alaska no longer has the opportunity for. Actually, we could build a state-based exchange, but unfortunately those federal dollars are no longer available to us. The second option is to build a state-designated exchange, which is that the state basically designates the federal exchange to be able to serve as their state-based exchange, therefore complying with the rules so that if King versus Burwell says that they're not individuals in federally facilitated marketplace states like Alaska, so an Alaskan who is no longer eligible under a federally facilitated marketplace, the state could designate the federally facilitated marketplace as their state marketplace so that those could continue. The third is a supported state-based exchange. The fourth is contracted, where a state could contract with another state. The fifth would be a regional exchange, where a number of states could work together to develop a regional exchange. And the sixth is a state-private exchange. And based upon our situation in Alaska, looking at the most cost-effective system available to us based upon what we did or didn't do as a state when those grants were made available to the states. The ones that the ones that are being pursued by the Division of Insurance are the state-designated exchange, the second option, or contracted state-based exchange options, which means for the first one, it's saying the federally facilitated marketplace will be designated as the Alaska exchange. The other option that's being considered is contracting with another state to be able to provide that service for us.
On that subject, Representative Sadler, Mr. Chair,
could you provide that to us in writing? I wasn't taking notes. Again, it sounds like you're saying that if there was a reduction through federal litigation in health care benefits to some Alaskans, that you would consider an awful lot of options to maintain that. You just listed six. I think I'd like to know the details of those.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, we'd be happy to provide that information.
Thank you. Representative Pruitt had a follow-up question, and we do have only 20 minutes left, folks.
Yeah, just a couple follow-ups real quick. I would assume that the closer to the poverty line, the higher the either subsidy or tax credit. Is that probably a fair assessment?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, that's correct.
If it's possible, could you let us know how many people fall within the expansion population that potentially might be impacted by this ruling, possibly the Rule 7 Commission.
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, we can try and get you that information.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Garrett and Representative Munoz.
Commissioner?
The commissioner.
Yes. Just a question on the donut hole. So when I believe Governor Cornell and the other governors sued to stop the Affordable Care Act, the ruling resulted in what's commonly referred to as a donut hole. People who will receive insurance subsidies but now don't get either insurance subsidies or Medicaid expansion. And can you explain what that gap is, and do you know roughly how many people that is who, because of that lawsuit, don't get insurance subsidies or Medicaid?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, we can get you some specificity on the exact number of Alaskans fall within that gap. I have it, I think, in my binder back there. But with the donut hole that was created by the Supreme Court resulted because, I guess you could have answered this, but I will. I was enjoying my seat in the second row today. Under the original Affordable Care Act as drafted, Medicaid expansion was actually a mandatory. Medicaid expansion was required of all states. The Supreme Court took act because some states sued, including Alaska, who joined in that litigation. Supreme Court determined that while the Affordable Care Act was constitutional, states could reject Medicaid if they chose to. And so individuals who are at less than 100% of the federal poverty level don't qualify for those marketplace subsidies. So if you are at less than 100% of the federal poverty level, you do not qualify. It's about $17,000 a year. You don't qualify for a subsidized insurance plan on the marketplace.
Just for the chair, the other part of the question.
Go ahead, Representative Garrett, and then we're going to have to move very rapidly because we've got 15 minutes left.
Thank you. So below 100% of the federal poverty line, you don't get subsidies now. And is there a group of other people below 100% of the federal poverty line that also don't get Medicaid without Medicaid expansion? Or
through the chair, Representative Garrett, yes, that is correct. And for the folks in the expansion population, folks who are newly eligible between the ages of 19 to 64, in 2016, of the almost 42,000 Alaskans who would be eligible under the expansion population, 23,344 are below 100% of the federal poverty level. So those are folks who would not be eligible for a subsidy on the federally facilitated marketplace.
Okay. Representative Munoz.
Thank you. As a follow-up to that question, then in Alaska, between 100% and 138%, do we know how many people are purchasing subsidized insurance that would transfer to Medicaid if the expansion goes through?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, we can get you that information.
Appreciate it. If you get it to us, we'll disperse it out, Tim. Again, we have 15 minutes left. Go ahead, Ms. Crayley.
Okay. The last case I want to talk about, and then Andrew can come up and talk about Medicaid fraud, is the Scott versus Department of Federal DSS. And in this case, I don't know if many are aware of this, but this is a recent case filed by Governor Scott of Florida, who is suing the federal government under an affordable care theory. The federal government provided Florida with about $1.3 billion in a grant to cover uncompensated care for individuals who are not Medicaid eligible or who are not receiving Medicaid to offset the cost of emergency room care. The federal government determined that they would end the grant in July, which is when the grant expired, and not give Florida the $1.3 billion, arguing that rather than give them the grant, they should expand Medicaid and get their coverage through the Medicaid expansion. Florida has sued the federal government, arguing that this is akin to the coercion argument that was found persuasive in the original Sebelius case. The suit was filed, I think,
Well, I do.
April 29th, so it's brand new. But it is a case related to expansion and that is currently pending in the federal courts. I don't know anything more about that other than what's in the slide.
Okay.
Okay. So with that, I'm going to turn this over to Mr. Peterson, and I'll operate this. So we'll go to slide 20.
Mr. Peterson, place yourself on the record. Go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Andrew Peterson. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law in the Office of Special Prosecutions, and I am the supervisor of the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. I want to talk briefly about a number of issues here today. First, just to give you all kind of an introduction and overview of the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, what our mission is, speak with you about how we've enhanced the ability to fulfill our mission by collaborating with other state and federal agencies, point out some of the results of this enhanced collaboration, the effectiveness it's provided our unit, the cost savings to the state of Alaska as a result of our collaboration and prosecutions, and ultimately some of the reforms that both myself and Stacey Curley's office have worked with the Department of Health and Social Services to kind of suggest and recommend. I think what I'll do is I'll kind of summarize the first few slides just to save time for the body here, since we're running short on time. To slide 20. So the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit was established in 1993.
Slide 21. Go ahead.
It was established in 1993 by federal regulation. Essentially what this regulation required was that all states have Medicaid Fraud Control Units nationwide. Currently there's 49 states and the District of Columbia have Medicaid Fraud Control Units. North Dakota is the only state that currently doesn't have a Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. The federal government sets forth certain performance standards and guidelines that we have to follow. Similar to the Department of Health and Social Services, we get audited periodically to make sure that we're being good stewards of the federal resources that we're receiving and we're complying with the rules. And the result, we have a 75% federal financial participation match. So slide 21. The Medicaid Fraud Control Unit's responsibility is essentially to investigate and prosecute medical assistance fraud, allegations of neglect and abuse, and financial exploitation or misappropriation of patient assets. That's not all the cases we prosecute. We do have statewide jurisdiction to prosecute any crime in the state of Alaska. And so essentially the way I describe it is if we have a Medicaid hook, if there's a Medicaid fraud abuse allegation that we're prosecuting, we'll prosecute any other crime that's involved with it. And if we don't have a Medicaid fraud hook, then that case goes on to another prosecutor, whether it's within a district attorney's office or the Office of Special Prosecutions. We do have a couple of limitations, and I'll transfer to slide 21.
Representative Sadler had a question on that slide.
Through the chair, Mr. Peterson, how many attorneys or how many staff do you have and what's your budget?
I appreciate that. I did mean to talk about that in the introduction, so I apologize. We have currently 10 individuals within the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit that consists of myself and another prosecutor, another assistant attorney general. We have 6 criminal investigators that consists of a supervising investigator and 5 line, and then believe it or not, the only forensic auditor in the state of Alaska.
The only what?
A forensic auditor. So she's an accountant who helps us understand or make sense of the numbers in front of us.
Continue.
Follow-up question.
Budget.
So I'll flip to the back. Roughly, kind of jumping back, but our budget for federal fiscal year 2014 was $1,105,990.
That's on slide 28.
Go ahead. Now, Representative Newman has a question now.
Yes. Going back with the Health and Social Services budget, I thought the Health and Social Services moves over about $6 million for fraud control.
So part of, through the chair, right, or
$7 million, I apologize, $1 million for fraud control.
Well, the money you're probably referring to, and I'm speculating here, is potentially part of the Department of Public Assistance, their fraud control unit. The establishment of the Medicaid fraud control units, one of the specific requirements is that we be independent from the Department of Health and Social Services. So our budget comes directly through, the 25% comes through the Attorney General's budget, and the remaining 75% through the federal match.
Okay.
I briefly mentioned we have some limitations on what we can prosecute. Essentially, as I said, we can't prosecute cases that are non-Medicaid. Normally, we don't prosecute recipient fraud, and I say normally because if we have a recipient case who's collaborating with a doctor or a provider, we will charge both of those together. And finally, our last limitation is data mining. We don't access the vast resources of Medicaid information we have to simply look for potential fraud. What we do is we take a referral from any source, primarily the Department of Health and Social Services. It could be a citizen, it could be a physician. When we receive a referral, that opens the door for us to initiate our investigations. Slide 23. The way we've been able to enhance our ability to investigate is through collaboration, primarily with the Department of Health and Social Services. I can tell you from meeting with other directors of Medicaid fraud units nationwide, we have one of the best relationships with a Department of Health and Social Services of any throughout the states. And it's bearing fruit, as I will show you when we talk about the results. But we have a close working relationship with the Department of Health. We also have a close working relationship with the civil unit. And what that really means is when the Department of Health is sending us a referral for a case and suggesting that we look into prosecuting a matter, I can work closely with Stacey Crayley's office and say, all right, this doesn't look like a case that I can prosecute criminally. Can you address it civilly? And we can collaborate to figure out how best to handle the case. If neither of us can address the concern the Department of Health and Social Services has, what it really tells us is we need to talk about some type of either regulatory reform or a request for statutory reform, because if this is a problem the Department of Health and Social Services wants to address and none of us can, we have to figure out a way to do it. And that's something that we actively work on in all of our meetings. Slide 24. This is just an extensive list of additional agencies we work with on a daily or a weekly basis. We work close with a lot of different federal agents and state law enforcement officers. The bottom three departments of Labor, Commerce, and Corrections, within the last 3 years, we have entered into memorandums of agreement with all three of them that allow us to share information. We receive data from all three of those, which, again, help us to fulfill our mission of prosecuting waste, fraud, and abuse within the system. Slide 25. So the results, this is really one of the most important areas. Since federal fiscal year 2012, we have filed criminal charges on 102 providers and or recipients. There's been a few recipients as part of this that have been colluding. We have secured 80 criminal convictions. All of those individuals have been suspended from providing Medicaid services almost indefinitely. Generally, it's a 10-year bar and then additional potential 10 years at the discretion of the Commissioner of Health and Social Services. We've secured 8 civil resolutions. These are claims that we've resolved civilly through the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit that maybe didn't rise to the level of a criminal charge or we worked out a negotiation.
Representative Sadler has a question.
Thank you. Very briefly and very quickly, that $2.8 million in restitution judgments, that's what the percentage of the losses, do you think?
Those were the... So you've heard a lot about audits that happen when the Department of Health is talking about them, how they look at statistically valid samples. For criminal prosecution, I have to have a verifiable loss. And what we do is we go in, and what we can prove in court is what our restitution judgments will be. And so this number, $2.8 million in judgments, are criminally court-ordered restitution judgments based upon the prosecutions.
So that's 100% of the proven loss, is what you're saying?
It's not ever 100% of the proven loss. It's what we can prove in court. I mean, there's oftentimes situations where we believe there's more loss, but we can't prove it. So this is what we can prove.
Okay.
And I hope I'm...
Not quite clear. I'm not sure. I guess I'm looking for imprecise. You're getting back $2.8 million. How much do you think you're losing? Rule of thumb, back in the hand calculation. 95%, 10%, 1%, just some.
You know, there are, through the chair, Representative Sadler, there are statistics by the FBI that estimate what percentage potentially of healthcare billing is fraudulent. That's an estimate. It's their best guess. I would say this $2.8 million, it would be nothing more than speculation if I was to tell you what percentage of potential health care fraud we're recovering. I can tell you it is 100% of what we have been able to prove in our criminal cases.
Yeah, but so I have no idea. I don't know what the FBI's are, but I have no idea if that is 100% or 1%. Any information you give me would be better than nothing.
Certainly, through the chair, Representative Sadler, the FBI statistics suggest that somewhere between 3 to 10% of all health care billing is fraudulent. If we take the 3% of FBI, if we take that FBI statistics at 3% and we apply it to the Medicaid system for the state of Alaska, you could potentially say that $45 million a year is fraudulent.
Thank you, sir.
And judgments are different than collections, isn't that correct? We haven't collected that much, that's just how much we had in judgments.
Representative Thompson, that is correct. I will tell you, however, I've been surprised at the amount of money we have actually recovered. The second thing that I would tell you is we recently got a fairly significant judgment, and one of the benefits of that, and it may be better to allow somebody from the Department of Health and Social Services to speak to this, but my understanding is once we identify a potential fraud or a fraudulent billing, the federal government essentially reaches back into the state's coffer and takes that amount of money that's the federal share back from the state. Essentially, they're saying, you've been poor stewards of the state resources. Once we convict or get a conviction against that defendant, and then we're able to show that the judgment is not collectible, we're actually able to get that money back from the federal government. So while we may not collect 100% of the funds that we get in restitution judgments, there is clearly a financial benefit back to the state of Alaska.
Okay. We've got about 5 minutes left, folks. Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peterson, Governor Newman took us here on the state a couple of years ago, and some of the testimony we got from fraud investigators was they felt it would be cost effective for us to hire more fraud investigators so we would make more money back in discovering fraud than we would pay out to the additional investigators. Do you have a background to say whether that would be accurate or not?
So, through the chair, Representative Guerra, I would say that based on the statistics I'm going to show you in my last slide, that would in fact be true. Initially, prior to 2012, the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit had 3 investigators, and we were prosecuting on average 0 to 3 cases a year. In 2012, when right about the same time I took over as the director of the unit, we expanded the number of investigators from 3 to 6, which greatly enhanced our ability to look at a larger number of cases. Since that time, we have dramatically increased both the amount of restitution and the number of prosecutions that we've secured for Medicaid fraud.
And then, Mr. Chair,
One follow-up, please.
Just so the committee knows, Mr. Peterson's sacrifice, he was once a well-known fishing guide, but now he's an attorney, so I'm sorry for that.
I knew fishing would be brought into this. Go ahead, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you. Additionally, on slide 26, just briefly, you can see that there's been 121 suspensions of Medicaid fraud providers based on credible allegations. This includes the 102 prosecutions that we've had and additional individuals that have been suspended based upon ongoing investigations. Slide 27 is the cost savings. This number is provided to us by the Department of Health and Social Services Program Integrity Unit, and the way they estimate this number is based upon the number of suspensions in each year. They estimate what are the cost savings going forward based on those suspensions, and that's $30 million since federal fiscal year 2013.
Representative Sadler, so that's just if the fraud hadn't been stopped, that's what would have continued?
That's Program Integrity's best estimate.
Go ahead.
Slide 28. Funding, and this is probably the most important for this committee, and it goes back to Representative Guerra's question. This shows what our total expenses are each year in 2012 through 14. The third line down is the state's 25% share. On the fourth line, we see the fines, and you can see in each year, starting in 12, going through 2014, we've increased the amount of fines that have been ordered by court order judgments. I can tell you there are 2 cases in which the defendants have already entered plea agreements, but sentencing is pending for this summer. It will result in $450,000 in additional fines being paid to the state of Alaska. Similarly, with restitution, you can see there's been an escalation in the amount of restitution we've been collecting as part of the prosecutions. Additionally, with the two pending cases that should be sentenced this summer, we anticipate in excess of $1.5 million additional restitution ordered to the state. In the national civil cases, just to briefly explain, one of the benefits the state gets by having a Medicaid fraud control unit is that we are able to participate in what's called NAMFUFU, or National Association of Medicaid Fraud Control Unit cases. These are national cases against healthcare providers or generally pharmaceuticals companies, and the state of Alaska is able to join in that civil litigation without having to fund the litigation itself. And the amount of money you see there in each of the respective years are civil judgments that have come in to the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit as a result of membership in the National Association. The last two things I'd like to point out here is just the return on investment. That is a return on the state's investment of the 25% share of the amount of money we've been getting back. I think that goes to Representative Guerra's question. We've been each year with the additional investigators that the legislature has funded for us. I've been able to bring in additional funds, and you can see on the bottom the number of convictions that we've secured each year since 2012.
Okay. This slide, very briefly, is just a calculation of the recoveries that my section has achieved over the last 4 years, state fiscal calendar years. These are actual recoveries that the Department of Health and the Human Services section has obtained as a result of the state recovery, trust recovery, third-party subrogation, and audits. Also, we have two attorneys who are dedicated and one and a half paralegals who are assisting with that, so it's a pretty good return on your investment as well.
So the last slide, page 30, reform. I'm going to kind of start at the bottom here. As I indicated, we go in our meetings when we're talking with Department of Health, we try to identify reforms that can be proposed. I would say that House Bill 161 by Representative Gaddis, that is a reform in an area that we have actually been looking at with respect to durable medical equipment. It's similar to recommendations in that area that have been talked about by the Department of Health and the Department of Law. Going back to the top, currently House Bill 148 has several reforms that have been proposed by both the criminal and the civil division of the Department of Law and Department of Health with respect to interest penalties for providers that have been either not necessarily fraudulently billing Medicaid, but potentially just billing Medicaid for services that aren't allowed or not keeping proper paperwork, and imposing civil fines. But the reason I think both of these are important is currently, if a provider is billing Medicaid in a manner that maybe isn't appropriate, or they're playing a little fast and loose with their records and they get caught, the only penalty is essentially a mulligan. Give us the money back, start over. And they have an opportunity to litigate in the administrative hearing process the state's claim that they owe us the money. This could take years, and during all of that time, there's no loss to the provider. There's no interest being charged on the money that the state's paid out. This committee's kind of said it repeatedly over the last couple of days that I've been listening. One of the ideas here is to make sure that providers have some skin in the game. These two proposals will ensure that providers have skin in the game. If they are billing Medicaid inappropriately, they're receiving funds that they weren't entitled to, they're certainly entitled to appeal or challenge those findings by the state, but at the end, if they were wrong, they could have to pay interest on those penalties, on those monies received. Additionally, the civil fines are important because this also gives us a way, but right now the only way we have to address providers that are doing something wrong is with a criminal charge, and that has significant consequences. The civil fines that we're asking the legislature to consider give us the option to remedy potential waste, fraud, or abuse without necessarily having to put a provider out of business. So it would result in the providers having skin in the game, but us having an opportunity or the ability to address potential wrongdoing without simply having to put a provider out of business. Finally, some of the revisions that we've worked with both on the civil side and the criminal side have been addressing revisions in the personal care attendant program. We've implemented a number of revisions over the past years, and I think you've heard from the director, Dwayne Mays, Senior Disability Services, the amount of money that's been saved in that arena. Some of that is due to prosecutions. A lot of it, most of it, is due to reforms implemented by Senior Disability Services.
Mr. Peterson, I thank you very much. I hate to rush this a little bit, but we have to wait for a legislator to vacate the room so the legislative budget and audit can set up. If committee members have any further questions, if they would get them to my Chief of Staff, Jane Pearson, she will get the answers and distribute those to all the members. I really appreciate it. Ms. Crayley, Ms. Woody, Mr. Peterson, I thank you very much for your presentation today. And we will reconvene tomorrow at 1 p.m. to continue our discussion on House Bill 148. And it is now 2:36 p.m. and we are adjourned.